Today I'm presenting my paper, Electronic Prescriptions for Controlled Substances, a Cybersecurity Perspective. So I wrote this paper with my two mentors, Sean and Bex, who are sitting there and there. So if you guys ask me hard questions, I might just point to them. Let's start. So basically, what did we do in this paper? Just give a high-level view. First, we examined a set of regulations we thought provided insufficient security guarantees, and basically we had a gut feeling that there were some big loopholes in it. We took some time to understand what these rules are and the process mandated by this set of regulations. We then identified potential areas of weaknesses in this mandated process or the components of an implementing system. Next, we highlighted some potential attacks. We drew upon well-known attacks in the area and some from our own experience. And finally, to make these better, we suggest some possible mitigations that we could possibly add to these regulations to make them to provide additional guarantees against these attacks. So, first of all, what exactly is Electronic Prescriptions for Controlled Substances, also known as EPCS? Basically, it's a set of rules published by the Drug Enforcement Administration, the DEA. They weren't exactly clear about what their the exact security goal was, but this is what you could get from their website. Basically, it aims to provide the ability to use these controlled substance prescriptions while maintaining a closed system of controls on controlled substances. So more discussion of this later, but this is their stated goal. Basically, it regulates the process of issuing and receiving these prescriptions. So there is an outline process, systems, applications used have to adhere to certain rules, and applies to all healthcare institutions, practitioners, and pharmacies that want to use and issue these prescriptions. So just a high-level view of how this process looks like. We basically have two applications. We have a practitioner application, and we have a pharmacy application. So one is responsible for making the prescription, and the other is responsible for receiving it. The practitioner logs on to his application. He's on his application. He first writes a prescription. So he fills in all the data fields, what drugs, how much, for who, so on and so forth. Then he completes two-factor authentication. So this is actually necessary before the prescription is signed off on. So he actually gets these credentials after doing some identity proofing from some authorities. And this could be either a hard token, two or three of a hard token, biometrics, or a password. So having done this, he can now sign the prescription in one of two ways. If he has a certificate that he's also gotten after identity proofing from a CA, he can sign it with the private key. Or he can actually just let the application sign it. The application actually stores his own private key, so the application can just sign on his behalf. Having completed the authentication, two-factor authentication is enough to tell the application that it's fine to sign for you. Then he sends out the prescription, and now the pharmacy application receives it. If it was signed the first way with the certificate, you have to verify the signature and check their certificate against revocation list. And if it's signed the application, the pharmacy application has its own private key as well. It signs off on it, and it archives it. So actually, this part of the signing process is a little bit vague in the regulations. We assume it's also a PKI system, asymmetric keys, and there's a similar verification going on. So once this is all done, and we know it's a good signed prescription, we process it, and whoever wants the drugs gets the drugs. So then we went on to think about how we want to access these this set of regulations. Given the fact that this is the DEA stated goal, we had to make some assumptions about what kind of security metrics to use or what the assumed goals of the DEA was. Our main metric is correctness, and we assume that this is a DEA goal. That is that only authorized practitioners should be able to issue prescriptions, and you know, substances should only be issued to people they are intended for. So we consider this the primary goal, and our next goal here, integrity, kind of helps achieve this. You know, we don't think that any logs or any transmitted prescriptions should be able to be modified, and you know, this, and if they can, people. Not you know, you could possibly get drugs you're not intended for you, or someone could cover up their tracks. We also consider confidentiality important. So just in general, protecting the privacy of medical records and controlled substance prescriptions are one of these. So that's a compliance issue as well. And availability, because controlled substance prescriptions, you know, might be an issue of life or death for some people. So you know, such a system should be able to be used when it needs to be used. So next, we came up with a kind of a rough diagram, kind of illustrating, you know, parts of this the process, or parts of the systems implementing this process, where we think attacks could come from. So kind of an attack surface diagram. So first, we think, you know, we have two-factor authentication, and we have any two of these three components that could be attacked. You use this, you authenticate to the practitioner system. So the application will be running on the system. This system likely will have other applications running on it. It has an operating system. And it actually has the cryptographic module as well. This guy is responsible for, you know, storing a private key and also performing the signing if you choose to sign with the, you know, if you choose to let the application sign for you. Then we have transmission over to the pharmacy system, which, you know, has the same components. Lastly, we expect these two systems to be connected to the internet, and you know, very possibly to an organizational network as well. So, all in all, this kind of represents the attack surface we see a potential adversary kind of considering when trying to subvert the system. So, now I'm just going to go on and talk about a few of the kind of broad areas of weaknesses that we discuss in our paper. The first being software. So we're kind of looking at these components that could be subverted. So first we look at what exactly is already in the standard. Basically not much. We need to maintain logical access controls. So people that can access the application, you need to be able to modify this on the go. And you know, there needs to be a central database of this, and it needs to be changed. It needs to be able to be changed at will. And next, the cryptographic signing module that lives on the practitioner and the pharmacy system, it needs to meet FIPS 142, security level 1. So I should have mentioned this earlier, but the module can actually be implemented in hardware or software. So if it was implemented in software, the operating system that the module runs on actually is subjected to some requirements under FIPS 142, security level 1. That is three main things. You need to restrict it to a single operator mode. It needs to protect private keys from other processes. And source code and binaries can't be viewed or changed. So, you know, we saw a bunch of problems with this, with these requirements. Well, one, FIPS security 142 security level 1 is not really very much of a guarantee. We looked into modules that were approved under FIPS 142 security level 1, and we realized that some of these requirements are not very strictly tested for. For example, single operator mode, we saw an implementation that was approved, I think it was Windows Server 2008 R2, because it basically supported single user login. So if one user logs in, no one else can use the computer at the same time, that's enough to fulfill the single operator requirement. Or another implementation, I believe this might have been OpenSSL. If you use virtual memory to segment your process address spaces, that also fulfills this requirement. So that's basically virtually every modern operating system. So not much of a requirement there. And protecting private keys from other processes, that's really hard to test. And the test requirements literally state, you know, the cryptographic module will sign a key, and some other process shall try to read its private key. So we don't feel confident in this testing process. Well, next, there are just no other requirements on this system. You know, this system could be, you could have bought it from Staples, and you know, you could have set up user accounts, and it would comply mostly to these requirements. So that's a concern because you know, we think other applications running on the system could very easily be compromised, and the operating system itself could is susceptible to attacks. So just some potential attacks we outline. It's kind of standard attack from the network, scanning the ports for software vulnerabilities, weaponizing it using any kind of penetration testing tool, and just delivering the payload, potentially giving you root access to the system itself. And we think this is an issue because this would open up possibilities of extracting the private key and forging prescriptions. So our metric for correctness might be violated if this should happen. So some possible mitigations. We basically suggest that some basic system hygiene be put in place, things a sysadmin would do. We point to NIST special publication 844. It's actually guidelines in securing public web servers, but you know, basically it outlines a lot of good guidelines in general for securing a system. So things like disabling unnecessary applications, requiring frequent patching of the OS, configuring user permissions and access privileges, so you know you might have logical access controls, but you need to control what users can do and how they can configure the operating system as well. And frequent security audits to make sure all this is functional. Next area we looked at was network security. So that would be, well, these components. And not much unlike the system software security, there's virtually nothing in it. In fact, there is no EPCS itself says nothing about network security, and none of the standards incorporated by reference have any requirements in this as well. We do consider this a second-order problem in that, you know, we don't think that this standard necessarily should, you know, tell you how to lock down a system completely from network attacks. But at the same time, we think it's necessary for the standard to provide some testable guarantees, you know, that we can, you know, that the system is actually secure to some extent. So, not having any mention of it is not acceptable. So, you know, we think that attacks could come from the network, delivered via the internet or a local network, or there could be attacks on the network itself that could route traffic in a malicious way. So, some examples of this. Just the same attack that I outlined before, delivering a payload weaponized from vulnerability sniffing over the network. Any kind of man-in-the-middle attacks that you might get from attacking the organizational network itself. So DNS spoofing, ARP cache poisoning, where you basically route traffic to a malicious computer. And this could... And a practitioner could then give up his credentials without knowing it to a man in the middle. So once again, our metrics for correctness are at stake here. So we point to the same regulations again for some basic network hygiene. That would be NIST special publication 844. So having a secure organizational network layout, proper firewall configuration, and any kind of intrusion detection systems would be helpful here. So any combination of these, depending on how much cost the regulations would like to impose and people implementing it. So next we look at key security, actually. So we're actually looking at these three components. Well, I say key security because, you know, technically, you know, lots of attacks on biometrics are physical as well. But we chose to kind of group this out into these three for these three modules because these three modules are actually responsible for storing a private key, and we are concerned that the private key can be extracted from any one of these modules, and potentially result in forged prescriptions. Sorry. So what's currently in there? Basically, the cryptographic module, if it's implemented in hardware, has to be FIPS 142 security level 1, and you know, same thing for the hard token. It has to be separate, a separate module, physical, and it has to be FIPS 142 security level 1. So what does FIPS 142 security level 1 require? Not very much. It has to be made of production-grade equipment, and you have to zeroize keys, if the debugging mode is accessed. So I guess the joke is that, you know, really what it is that documentation is required. Because FIPS 142 security level 1 is not much of a physical security guarantee at all. Production-grade equipment, that's pretty much anything that comes out of factory. And testing requirements for the second requirement, zeroizing keys, it doesn't give you very much of a guarantee, in that it's very much if the debugging mode is accessed, the keys have to be zeroized. So there's no, it's not a very rigorous guarantee on even attacking that interface. So potential attacks we see coming in, even just attacking the debugging, debugging access interface, FIPS 142 security level 1 doesn't really provide you testable guarantees against such attacks. And any kind of side channel attacks, for example, power analysis attacks, that's not guaranteed against in any way. So measuring the power output of these modules, physical modules, while they're performing cryptographic operations and potentially extracting private keys is very possible. And, you know, some more obscure attacks that might be harder to defend against, like cold booting attacks where you basically aim to extract memory from a live system by lowering the temperature of RAM. You could do that as well. So when suggesting possible mitigations for this, we do understand that some of these, we do acknowledge that some of these attacks are pretty hard to defend against, and they're in very much general problems with hardware implemented modules in general. So there is a cost-benefit trade-off here, but we do think that to achieve our security metrics of correctness, we recommend a FIPS 142 security level 3 requirement. So security level 2 actually requires that you have tamper-evident seals. So what that is that if someone physically tampers with your device, there have to be ways, you know, it should be immediately obvious, it should be immediately detectable on a later audit. FIPS security level 3 takes this one step further and requires that there are tamper-responding physical mechanisms that, should attacker try to physically tamper with it, you know, keys must be zeroized, or, you know, the device has to blow up or something, you know, something like that, whatever it takes to protect private keys. We recommend that some kind of countermeasures maybe be taken against power analysis attacks, and that could come in the measure of in the form of signal blurring, using dual rail logic. A bunch of these are outlined in Jordan Oliver's paper. And in general, just regular clearing of private keys from memory, just to make it harder to extract memory and look for private keys in memory. So the last part I'm going to look at would be transmission. So that would be this phase of the electronic prescriptions process. What's interesting is that, you know, EPCS standard requires that you protect the transmission from modification, and clearly that's important for the correctness of this process. While the prescription is going from the practitioner application to the pharmacy application, it cannot be modified in any way. Its file format has to remain the same, and any intermediary that interacts with it should not change it in any way. That's good, but it does not stop you from leaving it unencrypted and having an adversary read your entire application in plain text. We suspect that this might, you know, it might have been left out there because confidentiality might not have been a DEA goal as part of these regulations, but it's part of our security metrics, and therefore we suggest using TLS when sending out electronic prescriptions. And this is a compliance issue as well. HIPAA actually requires that you protect these individually identifiable health records as well. So we believe this is important and quite an easy fix. So, I mean, there are a bunch of other security weaknesses that we cover in our paper. I'm not going to go into it in this presentation, but basically about the biometrics and the password policy, basically parts of the two-factor authentication system. So read our paper for more information on that. You know, we have some general conclusions from this paper, in that clearly we think that there are some gaping loopholes in the current regulations, especially when it comes to the software and network security. We believe there are many easy fixes as well, especially for these two parts. Requiring any kind of basic system hygiene would help mitigate a lot of these threats. And at the same time, there are a bunch of attacks that are a lot harder to defend against as well. And we believe that to some extent, you know, we should try to increase attacker costs. ultimately, it comes down to, you know, trade-off between cost and security. And it's a bit of an issue when the goals of the DEA in terms of what level of security we're trying to achieve are kind of vague. So some lessons learned about, I guess, regulations and standards in general regarding cybersecurity. We think it's really important to establish security goals from the start. So once again, I refer you to this quote. It's unclear. Well, correctness, I think you based on what the DEA does, it's quite probable that that's what they want. But things like confidentiality, it's not clear if the DEA aims to achieve that. And it's also unclear what level of security the DEA want to achieve with these regulations. And when there's any vagueness in the regulations, it would be nice to have some stated general principles, guidelines that are very specific to kind of go back to, so that there's no so people implementing the system can have a better idea of what they actually want to achieve, rather than just following the rules. And next, accepted standards, don't necessarily imply a secure system. We believe that in making and coming up with standards and regulations, it's very important to understand the risks that are being faced by the system, by the process, and to cite standards, choose standards that provide adequate guarantees against this risk. So, for example, FIPS 142 Security Level 1 is cited a lot in EPCS, but we don't think it provides sufficient guarantee at all, even against the most basic levels of attacks. And next, regulations should be conservative. We do think that the FIPS 142 Security Level 1 requirements probably there to kind of lower costs for implementers and therefore increase adoption of electronic prescriptions. But at the same time, you can very much expect implementers to want to save costs and to kind of go with the minimum standard. And that minimum standard has to be high enough to achieve your security goals. And lastly, it's really important to be specific where it counts, and specifically, in terms of imposing regulations on the systems that an application will realistically run on. We do believe that something has to be said about it. In fact, probably something specific, because otherwise, we do think the security of the entire system is very much jeopardized by that vagueness. Yep, and that's it. Any questions?
So it's been some time since I work on the e-prescriptions, but so cost. Did you compare the cost of what implementing your recommendations and so on? What that would do to the cost of an e-prescription system?
Not really. That we didn't exactly do that in this paper. It's very much a general security analysis and policy critique. But we do acknowledge that something like level 3 comes at significantly higher costs. So for us, the main issue is that it's not clear what level we're trying to achieve either, but probably will be more expensive. I'm sure you know this better than me.
Yeah, because the other side is, so if adopting e-prescription becomes expensive, then doctors will just continue issuing the prescriptions on paper, and that's vastly more risky, as you might imagine, because you have to hand the prescription to an individual to take to the pharmacy. And that is completely subject to corruption. And lastly, one more point that I'll make while I'm pontificating here is that so in a lot of cases, even implementations of this e-prescription standard, the doctor does not actually go through two-factor authentication. The doctor simply instructs somebody in the office to go through the two-factor, which obviously means if that individual is corrupt, you lose, right?
That's true.
That's a huge problem, just so you know.
I actually think there are specific instructions in the regulations that you're not allowed to say give your password out to anyone else. I think they do allow you to do allow someone else to perform the authentication for you, but on the condition that you bear the full brunt of the responsibility if anything goes wrong. So I imagine it's done pretty often.
This is Jean Stanford from Novus. Did you see anything in there about use of mobile devices, and do you have any additional recommendations based on that?
No, it's actually the regulations are pretty broad in terms of what it could be implemented on. It was kind of, in fact, most of those requirements were very much on the physical components and the application itself that runs this process. So it's a very general set of standards that very much could apply to a mobile phone or tablet. We haven't really thought about that or have any specific recommendations for mobile devices.
Thanks very much.
Thank you.